Great seeing you. Wanted to give you a glimpse of some of the baptism we had just last weekend. And so I think we baptized close to 20 or 25 people last Sunday, and then, you know, several more a couple weeks before that. And yeah, God just continues to be up to good things and to great things. And I know sometimes that it's not something that all of you guys get to see or notice. And so we just want to give you a glimpse that, man, every single week around here, God is up to radically changing people's lives and helping start new beginnings. And so thank you. Thank you for being you and the type of community that you are. This time, an usher is going to come forward, and they're going to give us a chance to continue to partner financially and to be a part of that life change. And so if you came prepared to give, this would be the time to do that. And as they do, just again, thanks for your faithfulness in that. And your faithfulness in giving continues to allow environments like this to continue to be created. And so that people week after week that are coming and discovering what it means to trust Jesus and seeing their lives changed. And I was talking to one woman last Sunday as she was being baptized, and I just said, you want to say anything? And she just said, you know what? Yeah, a year ago, a friend invited me to the Christmas Eve services, and I came, and now, man, through this past year and being a part of this community, I've learned what it means to forgive, but I've also learned what it means to be forgiven. And so I want to come. I want to surrender my life to Jesus and just in this tangible way, trust him and being baptized today. And in that moment, and I just found myself just so grateful for all of you and for this community and all that you do to help make all this possible. And so just thank you for your continued faithfulness and all of that. We've been talking the last couple of weeks about the Christmas services that are coming up. So just as a reminder for that, Tuesday the 21st at 7, and then Wednesday at 7, Thursday at 7, Friday at 1, 3, 5, and 7. The tickets are distributed outside in the lobby here, so if you haven't got yours yet, I'd highly encourage you to do that. They are going quickly, and so I want to make sure that you guys can get tickets if you want to be here. We're trying to make sure that anyone who wants to have a seat can, and so again, the tickets are free, absolutely free. They just help us in distributing the crowds. So you also need to know, too, if someone comes without a ticket and you forget those, it's not like we turn you away and say, sorry, you know? It's just a way for us to help plan better, and so if you could help us out in that, it would be a huge benefit to us as we work through that. Also, as a reminder, with those services, the following Sunday, December 26th, we'll not be gathering together here on Sunday morning. And so we'll have services kind of all week long. And so we won't meet here on Sunday morning, December 26th. We'll resume meeting here together on January 2nd. And so just in case anyone kind of asks or you ask this question, we're not canceling church. You know, you're the church, so we can't cancel you. And, you know, all of us together as a people and as a group and as a community, we're just not gathering on Sunday morning on that particular week. So last thing I just want to share with you, another moment of huge gratitude I had for all of you this past week was on Monday morning. We're kind of going through the weekend and reviewing Sunday, and so come to Pam, who's kind of our missions pastor, and she told me that all 420 tags from the Durham Rescue Mission were taken last week by you guys, all of them. And it's just amazing. And the Durham Rescue Mission called, and they were on update, and they said, so we just want to kind of get a count on how many tags that you guys were able to distribute. Kind of, we know it's the first Sunday, and so we just kind of want to know just how many were you able to get? How many do you have left? And Pam's like, yeah, we have zero left. And she's like, there was dead silence on the other end of the phone, you know? No, like, really? And we're like, no, yeah, there's zero left. And just tearing up and just grateful, and they were tearing up and just amazed at you guys. And I'm so proud of you. I mean, just, again, one Sunday just to knock all that out. And an amazing thing is that these aren't kind of cheap gifts, you know, that are on the tree. Some of you probably got one of those tags and like gulped, you know, a little bit. And you were expecting Light Bright and you got a Toyota. And, but again, it just speaks to your overwhelming generosity and your commitment to keep loving and to love radically well. And I'm so proud of you. And it's just that continued commitment to figure out what's it mean to love and to build a relationship with a mission here locally so that they trust our community, that they would rely on us and they could lean on us. And that was the goal from the beginning, is how do we get consistent in loving them and get our community involved heavily in what they're doing so we could build this type of strategic relationship. I was reflecting back on this past week too, that 2.5 years ago, we started out with this idea of, I wonder if our community could serve 10 weeks in a row meals once a week to the Durham Rescue Mission. I wonder if we could actually own 10 weeks in a row of one day a week serving meals. And that was a big gulp for us. We didn't know if we could commit to that, but we did and said, well, let's just give it a shot. And now here we are, 2.5 years later, with 130 weeks in a row of this community providing meals once a week for the Durham Rescue Mission. And again, that's just because of you and your commitment to love really well. And I just could not be prouder as your pastor and of who you are and what God is doing in and through you. And so just thanks for being you. This morning, what I want to do is I want to, in terms of the message, I want to stand on the shoulders of what Steve introduced last week and dive a little bit further into the life of Mary. And then kind of at the end of it all, I just want to present you with a few questions. And you're going to feel like, wait a second, where's kind of all the practical steps and where's kind of all the hands-on stuff and life application? I'm just going to kind of tell you up front. There's not going to be a whole lot of that. It's really going to be what you do with it once you leave here. And so what I want to do is I want to spend some time with Mary, though, because Mary can tend to be a polarizing figure among Christians for a variety of reasons. But the reality is there's really a lot that we can learn from her and that we can learn from her life. But in order to do that, we got to kind of go backwards for a bit. And I've got to give you some context. And this morning is going to feel more like a Bible study than maybe a typical message around here. But I'm pretty confident that it's just important that we get this kind of groundwork laid. That there needs to be a framework for how we understand the scriptures and how we understand the story of the scriptures and what God is up to. Because many times, what gets assumed is that God was up to something completely new when it comes to the Christmas story. That when the angel's announcement came to Mary and with the birth of Jesus, that he's up to something completely new. That up to that point in history, many of us assumed that God was always about law. But that with the birth of Jesus and the beginning of the New Testament, all of a sudden we're introduced into this new idea of God's grace. And so I want to explore that idea. And the way I want to do it is I want us to go back to the very first book of the Bible, to Genesis chapter 12. And so if you have a Bible, I invite you to turn there, the very first book in your Bible, Genesis chapter 12. And if you don't have a Bible, then we'll put the words on the screen. You can follow along that way. But what we find here in Genesis chapter 12 is a critical foundational moment in history. And so we've had Adam and Eve in the garden and their distrust of God and walking away. Then you have Noah and the flood and, you know, continued distrust and God, you know, starting over again. And then we have this period of time after the flood, after Noah, where people then again forgot about God and started to not place their trust in God, but rather trust themselves. And so we have generations that pass. Hundreds of years go by, hundreds and hundreds of years, possibly thousands of years go by, and people have long forgotten about God. And the world has only become more and more tainted by sin and corrupted by selfishness. And the reality is that God at this point could have just chosen to do nothing. Could have said, you know what, I've tried, and let's just walk away from it all. But instead, God chose something else. God chose to step into the chaos. He chose to step in to the destruction and to the miserable state of the world. And he chose to initiate a plan of redemption, of restoration. And it wasn't because anyone deserved it. It wasn't because anyone had earned it. But it was simply because of God's grace. It was simply because of his love. And you see, the grace of God doesn't first appear on the scene in the New Testament in the story of Jesus, but rather from the very beginnings of human history, we see evidence of God's grace in the world and in people. And we see it all throughout the scriptures from the very first book in Genesis all the way through. Now, from a cultural standpoint, at this point in history, what you have are nations and families that worshiped what they would call regional or territorial gods, where depending on where you lived, you believed that there was a god unique to your particular territory, to your particular nation, and that was the god or the gods that you and your family worshiped. And so rather than trying to convey a whole new system of cultural understanding, God did what he often does. God leveraged the current system. He leveraged the current worldview and understanding, and God decided to begin his redemption plan in the world with a nation. A nation that would be chosen by him to put on his love on display for the world, to put his character and his goodness on display, to put his power on display. A nation that would serve as his mouthpiece to the world. A nation that he would place strategically in the center of ancient culture so that this nation would be able to interact with the broadest cross-section of cultures possible. And not only that, but this would be a nation he would enter into a covenant relationship with, that God would treat this nation as a parent treats a child, and that he would be committed to them forever out of this relational love, not because this nation or these people did anything to earn it or to deserve it, but simply because of his grace, simply because it was his love that compel them. And so understand, this was the foundation for God's redemption plan. But unfortunately, at the time, all the existing nations and civilizations already had gods that they claimed as their own. There were already certain ingrained habits and patterns and practices that these cultures had adopted that stood in opposition to the character of God. So instead of trying to reform a current nation, all their existing kind of understandings and beliefs about God, their practices and habits that were directly in opposite of God's character, God decided to start a brand new nation of people. Now, this isn't the fastest way to go about the redemption plan, to start a nation from scratch. But God was willing to be patient. And it was the simplest, most purest form to go about building it. And so God decides to start a nation with one man, with one individual. And the plan was to make a covenant with this one man, and then he would have children, and then his children would have children, and that would continue on for generation after generation after generation to eventually that this one man's descendants would become a nation. A people, through being heirs of this one man, would all then fall under the covenant promise that was made in the beginning. And so God chose what would seem to be one of the most unlikely people for this incredibly important mission, a man named Abram. Later on in the scriptures, we'd see that God changed Abram's name to Abraham, which is the name that many of us are more familiar with. But originally, he was named Abram. And of all people, Abram would not seem like the prime candidate to start a nation with, to kind of start from scratch and build this nation of people. After all, Abram was over 70 years old at the time. And he was over 70 years old, and he had zero children. Not only did he have zero children, his wife was considered barren. And this was the man that God decided to start to build a nation through. And this is what he says to him. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. It says, the Lord said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I show you. And so the first thing, verse 1, God invites Abram to trust him. Invites him to say, okay, I want you to trust what I'm telling you to do. And then he makes three incredible promises to him. He says, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Now just imagine for a moment what Abram must have been thinking. I mean, all the excuses that would have run through his head, all the doubts, for Abram to look around at his current circumstances, for his current stage of life, and say, how in the world can this be? There's absolutely no way. He had to have been thinking that. That had to go through his mind. But yet, even with all those questions, with all those certain doubts, Abram chose to trust God and to step into the story that God was beginning to weave. And it ended up that through Abraham, God launched the nation of Israel. But I want you to notice something, that when God initiated his relationship with Abram, he began with simply asking him to trust the promises he was giving him. That's what he invited him to trust. Will you trust the promises that I'm giving you? Promises that Abram, notice, he didn't deserve. These weren't promises that Abram asked for. He hadn't earned them. But you see, God initiated a relationship with Abram simply by inviting him to trust what he was promising. And the reality is, God has been initiating relationships with people that same way from the beginning, by grace. That God has always invited us into relationship with him by grace, by inviting us to trust what he says about who we are, to trust that he'll do what he says that he'll do. It's how people have entered into a relationship with God from the very beginning, by grace. And yet so often we tend to struggle with this kind of default mentality that God really initiates a relationship with us based on how well we behave according to his rules. Whether or not we've kind of cleaned ourselves up enough or gotten in line with God's laws more times than we haven't. And we can be told different things, and we may have learned different things or been exposed to different things, and we can carry a different idea in our head, but many times in our heart, deep down in our soul, we just kind of default to this mentality because it seems like common sense to us, because all of us recognize that there is a gap. There's a gap that exists between how we're living and how God would want us to live. Every civilization throughout history has carried some sense of this gap with them. And so it's normal for us to think that if bad behavior is what creates this gap between us and God, then good behavior would be the thing that would bring us back. And so our default mentality is to keep trying to do something to behave our way into God's acceptance and approval. That we can somehow behave our way back into God's good graces. And that's what we've seen throughout history. Civilizations, generation after generation, people kept coming up with and continue to come up with every type of system and scheme imaginable to try to appease God or to try to please their gods. But understand, what we find in the Bible and the scriptures is that when God, Yahweh, initiated his relationship with mankind, it didn't begin with behavioral rules to adhere to. It didn't begin with this dictator demanding to get all cleaned up. It began with an invitation to trust what God was promising. Promises that were offered, not because we earned them, not because we deserved them, but because of grace. You see, grace has been around from the very beginning. Now, for some of us, when we hear that idea, especially with how it relates to the Old Testament, there's this disconnect that happens. And that disconnect can happen for a variety of different reasons, and this isn't the time to try to address all of them. But one of the primary reasons is that many of us have kind of moved along in our journey of faith, making a certain assumption that we tend to associate the Old Testament only with law. The Old Testament was all about the law, and specifically the Ten Commandments. But then when we get to the New Testament, when we get to the birth of Jesus, it's suddenly all about grace. And so the assumption goes that the way one entered into a relationship with God in the Old Testament was through obeying the law, was through obeying the Ten Commandments. That grace didn't enter the picture until much later. But you see, there's something very important for us to understand about the story of God and his redemption plan, and that is that the Ten Commandments and the 600 other plus laws that we find, you know, in the Old Testament, and if you've ever tried to read your way through the Bible, you try to navigate through in Leviticus and Numbers and all the different laws that are given, you need to understand, those laws, and specifically the Ten Commandments, they're not opposed to grace. They don't stand in opposition to grace. But rather, the Ten Commandments and all the other laws that would follow in the Old Testament are introduced, and this is key, they're introduced within the story of grace. They're introduced under the umbrella of a grace story that was already being told. Where what we find is God raising up a man named Moses to deliver his people out of slavery in Egypt from Pharaoh. Where the Israelites had been slaves for more than 400 years. And through a miraculous series of events, and you hear about the plagues and all the different things with Pharaoh and with Egypt that God initiated, all these miraculous events, God frees his people from the bondage of slavery in Egypt, not because of anything they had done to earn it or deserve it, but again, God simply saying, these are my people, these are my children, I have to rescue them. And so understand the context under which the Ten Commandments are given is you have a nation of people who have just been rescued and who have known nothing but slavery for 400 years. You have a people who have never been responsible for themselves, a people who've never had a government, who've never had a king, who've never had any sort of judicial system, people who've never had any laws. And it's to this nation and this story of his rescue of them that God introduces the Ten Commandments, these behavioral guidelines on how to live and how to best live life, laws that would also reflect the goodness and the character of God. Because in the ancient world, gods were typically seen as these power, you know, hungry mongers, these dictators, these cruel, you know, and evil kinds of forces and powers. And God wanted to make sure that his laws that were reflective of his character and his goodness. And so understand, the Ten Commandments weren't about ever creating a system of determining who's in and who's out. You know, of determining who could earn their way into God's family and who deserved to be in because they could keep the commands better than the next person. You see, God gave Israel laws not to establish his relationship with them. God gave Israel laws because they were already in relationship with him. That's a big difference. Laws weren't given to establish relationship. Laws were given because they were already in relationship. You see, the difference between treating Israel as a parent and treating Israel as a dictator, when you're a parent, relationship is the highest value, but rules don't determine the relationship. When it comes to dictating, rules do determine the relationship because it's all about who has power and who doesn't. But that's not the story God invites us into. It's not the story God invites anyone into. Because you see, from the very beginning of the scriptures, what we continually find is that God initiates relationships by grace, by inviting people to trust him, to trust his promises. And it's the same story we see in the beginning of the scriptures all the way through. And it's the same pattern we see as we approach the story of Christmas, as we approach the story of Mary in the New Testament. Look at Luke chapter 1. Starting with verse 26. It says, in the sixth month, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." The angel goes on to say a couple verses down, verse 31, "You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great, and he will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end." So once again, in this continued story of God's redemption, what we see is God choosing an unknown young girl. And it's the very same pattern. He invites her to trust him and to trust his promises. Now, when it comes to Mary specifically, sometimes we find it difficult to relate because some of us carry this idea with us that somehow Mary was chosen because she was better than everyone else. That somehow Mary was exceptional at keeping the law. That perhaps she carried out the law perfectly. And in some way, she earned this honor of being approached by God. Which puts us back in this mentality of that God uses people who deserve it or who earned it. When the reality is that's never been the story God is weaving throughout history. But one of the reasons we assume that of Mary is when the angel says in verse 28, it says, the angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." Now, I want us to look at the phrase "highly favored" for a moment, because it seems to imply that God looked down and said to Mary, "You know what, you're my favorite, you're my most obedient child, and so I'm going to pick you." Now, as we mentioned often, the New Testament was originally written in Greek, and the combination of words used in the Greek gets translated as "highly favored." That combination of words is fairly unique. In fact, it only occurs one other time in the New Testament. It's found in the book of Ephesians. Chapter 1, verse 6. It says, "To the praise of his glorious grace, which he has freely given us in the one he loves." Now that phrase, "glorious grace," those same combination of words is what gets translated as "highly favored" later on or earlier in Luke. And so the idea of grace, when you think about it to begin with, the very definition of grace is undeserved favor. And what we see here in Ephesians is a reminder that this high favor, this glorious grace, only comes about because God has freely offered it. And that's the same language we find when the angel addresses Mary, that Mary being highly favored isn't because she's done something or earned it. It wasn't because she was perfect. In fact, in the scriptures, we see where Mary offers a sacrifice when she comes to the temple. She offers a dove sacrifice, which was considered to be a sin offering. This was to say, you know what, I'm offering a sacrifice based on, you know, things that have happened and gone wrong and sins of my past. And so this wasn't because she was perfect, but rather it was because she was a recipient of God's grace. The same grace that is offered to everyone. That is what made her highly favored. It was because she received and was a recipient of God's grace, the same grace that he offers to you, the same grace he offers to me, to everyone. And yet it's also important to understand that that reality doesn't cause Mary to fade into the background of insignificance, as some can try to push her into on one side of the polarizing tension when it comes to Mary's life. Rather, it was simply the context in which this ordinary yet courageous young woman chose to trust the promises of God. And she trusted and had the courage to trust that God was going to do what he said he was going to do. Now, for many of us, the picture that we carry of Mary when we think about her in our mind is this kind of very nice, gentle, pious, almost kind of emotionless young woman. And we get that picture from, you know, paintings. We get it from, you know, children's books, children's plays. And, you know, she's always kind of in this, you know, blue gown and just kind of very somber. But the Mary that we find in the scriptures is a woman worth modeling, that she's courageous and she's bold. It's this young woman confident in the promises of God. When invited to trust him, she courageously trusted the faithfulness of God. Even when she would have looked around at her circumstances, she would have known that she had plenty of reasons, plenty of excuses to think, how in the world can this be? I have no reason to try to trust God in what he's saying, other than I've seen God. I've seen him show himself faithful throughout generations and throughout time. And so she chose to trust him. She chose to trust his faithfulness. She chose to trust his promises, even though her current circumstances didn't lend evidence to the fact that she should. In fact, soon after being told of his promises, Mary, this bold young woman, she begins to sing. For generations, it's a song that's been known as the Magnificat, an ancient hymn that has been sung by generations of Christians. Now, I won't go through it all, but I want you to notice what she starts singing in Luke chapter 1, starting with verse 50. She says, speaking of God, his mercy extends to those who fear him from generation to generation. He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, even as he has said to our fathers. Now, there's a couple things worth pointing out about what Mary sings that gives us more insight into the kind of impressive woman that she was. One, most everything Mary sings is drawing on parallel images and quotations from the Old Testament. She pulls from this story of Hannah that we see in Samuel. She pulls quotations from Isaiah. And she pulls from all these different promises that God had made throughout previous generations of what it was to mean with a Messiah that was coming into the world. And so what you have here is you have a very young girl, but one who is very familiar with the story that God was weaving throughout history. You have a young woman who is paying attention. You have a young woman who was looking at what was going on and paying attention to God's story of faithfulness and immersing herself in it so that she was much more aware of how to interpret her current circumstances. So you need to understand that this is a song that she sings in the cultural context of Roman oppression. I mean, it's one thing for us to read her words now and kind of place her, you know, as this somber, emotionless, you know, quiet, nice young woman, but this was a song that she was singing out loud in a culture where rulers like King Herod arrogantly and violently oppressed Israel, where they were making sure that they kept getting richer and the poor and the Israelites kept getting poorer. And so to even speak out loud of rulers being overthrown and the rich being sent away empty-handed was dangerous language. It was revolution language. It was the kind of language that often got people killed. But it was Mary's trust and confidence in the promises of God that fueled this conviction that she trusted his faithfulness to his promises. So much so that as you read her song, I want you to notice that she sings the realities of what was to come. And when she sings the phrases in the past tense as if it had already happened. Verse 52, he has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel. Mary's confidence wasn't in her own merit, but completely based on her confidence in God's faithfulness. Now, there's one last thing I want to point out with Mary. It's what we find in Luke chapter 2, kind of toward the end of what we would consider the Christmas story. And it's right after Jesus has been born, and Mary and Joseph are visited by the shepherds. And the shepherds are telling her about the star that was sent to them to follow and introduce them to the new king. They're telling them about the angels that appeared to them out of the sky to announce the birth of the new king and inviting them to follow. And Mary is looking back on all these events that have taken place in the last 10 months. And she says this, and Luke records this in chapter 2. He says, "But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart." Now, when we tend to think of someone treasuring and pondering, we kind of tend to think of someone kind of withdrawing off into the corner with this silent meditation. But this idea of treasuring and pondering was a common phrase in Judaism for someone thinking about the events of one's life so that they could try to make sense of what God was doing in history. And so Mary isn't removed in the corner just merely kind of soaking on everything that's happened, but she's actively trying to figure out what God is up to and what it looked like for her to continue to step into the story that he was inviting her in. And so to kind of wrap this up this morning, here's a couple of questions I just want to leave you with that I think are worth wrestling through. And that is, when's the last time that you paused and you stopped to seriously consider how the events of your life, how the circumstances of your life, how the things that God has brought you through and carried you through up to this point, that you would take time to consider the lessons that you've learned, the wisdom that you've gained, that you would take time to look and consider the opportunities that are before you and your passions and your gifts and your resources, and that you take time to consider the faithfulness of God throughout history, and that you would ask yourself the question, God, what is it that you want me to step into? Considering all of this, that when I really pay attention to it, God, what is it that you want me to step into? God, how does my life align with the redemption and the resurrection story that you're up to in the world? That God, I'm not just going to keep living with no vision for my life without paying attention to what it is that you may want to do in me or what you're already doing, but I just haven't paid attention to. That I don't just want to keep going kind of on the rat race and treadmill of life without stopping and paying attention and treasuring and pondering what it is that you're doing, what it is that you've been doing, and the kind of story that you want me to step into. Maybe that story for you, it could be relational. Maybe it could be vocational. Maybe for you, it's simply the matter of small decisions that you find yourself having to make every single day that can be a continued part of this redemption and resurrection story. Maybe for you, there's other questions also worth wrestling through. Maybe for you, it's what promises of God do you find yourself struggling to trust? That the way that we enter into relationship with God is by choosing to trust his promises. The way we continue to step into God's story is by choosing to trust his promises. And so what promises of God are you struggling to trust? And now some of you may think, well, you know what? And it'd be a lot easier if an angel came down to me, you know, in a dream and said, here you go, you know? Well, then I would trust those promises. Maybe for you, you know, you've never maybe discerned God maybe speaking to your heart or in your thoughts or tried to understand what that could sound like. And so it's not even an out loud thing for you. It's just a, man, I don't even know what it is that God is speaking to me or what promises that he may be trying to invite me to trust. So what about the promises that God's already made to you? The promises that he's already given you in Scripture. Promises like that through your trust in Jesus, that God will make you new. He will create in you a new heart. That you will become a forgiven person and God will begin to transform you. God's promise that through Jesus, he doesn't define you by what you've done wrong. He doesn't define you by your sin. He doesn't define you by your failures. But as his child, that no matter what you've done, that that's how he sees you. Maybe you think you don't deserve God's grace. Maybe you think that you don't clean up well enough, or you haven't got yourself cleaned up well enough yet to start journeying with God. maybe the promise he's inviting you to trust is that through Jesus, he already wants to redeem you and to resurrect you, and together with you, redeem and resurrect the world. That his promise for you, for every single one of us, is that that's what he wants to do in your life if you're willing to just trust his promise that he'll be faithful to do what he says that he'll do. Maybe you find yourself tired and exhausted and worn out, and you look around at the world and you just find yourself without hope. Maybe the promise that you need to cling to is that God promises he has not abandoned you. He will not abandon you. That he is up to good things in the world, even when our current circumstances around us, on our current time frame, and in our impatience, it might not seem like it is. But that God is always faithful to his promises to resurrect and to redeem the world. Maybe there's a very specific way that you know God is asking you to trust him. You know it. I mean, you've heard that same thought, this recurring thought come to mind over and over again, those promptings, these nudgings, whatever it is that you want to call it. You've got different people in your life coming to you and speaking these things to you, and it's starting to freak you out because it's like, okay, I get it. I know this is what God is inviting me to do. I know he's asking me to trust him in this way. It seems like every time I even walk into church, it's just, this is what I hear, and this is what people are saying, or every time I walk into this, have a conversation with this friend or with this person, the same thing keeps coming up. You know what it is that God's inviting you to trust, but you have all these different excuses of why you can't. You kind of live your life on these, you know, with bar graphs and charts, and you say, you know what, I base it totally on this, you know, this kind of information that I can see and that I can touch, and as I look at my circumstances, this doesn't make sense, and yet you know that God's inviting you to trust him in some specific way. And so what is that? What's keeping you from doing that? Because he's just simply inviting you, as he has from the beginning, inviting you to trust him, inviting you to trust his promises. And so my hope is this morning, as we kind of get this context and we kind of get this understanding of what God has been up to, this isn't a new idea that God is up to with the birth of Jesus, but this is the story that has always been. My hope is that you're reminded that this is God's heart for you, that this is God's story. It is a story of grace. And that his invitation is always one of simply, will you trust me? And that each of us would leave here determined to find some way to have the courage to say yes to whatever it is God is inviting you to whatever role he's asking you to play in the same story he's been weaving throughout history. And that we would see where the adventure takes us. So let's pray. Father, thank you for my brothers and sisters here. And my simple prayer is that we would be the people that continue to trust you and trust your promises. And we would know that you are for us, that you're our Father, and that you're committed to us. And it's not based, and your love and your grace isn't based on how well we behave or don't behave, but it's based on your grace, your commitment to us. So Father, may we rest in that and courageously move forward into the story you're inviting us into, because we trust and know that it is in that story that we will find life. And we pray this in the name of the resurrected one, Jesus. Amen. Thanks, friends. We'll see you next Sunday.